Thank you so much, Neil. Neil introduced my poems to the UK and to the rest of the world through that anthology, and I am quite pleased to have made his acquaintance, and I appreciate all of his support. Thank you also to all of you, everyone here at Ledbury, who have anything to do with putting this event, this entire festival together. I know it's a lot of hard work. We're smiling, but we're also running around trying to make sure things go smoothly. So can we give this town a hand, really, seriously? And it's really wonderful to be here with so many new friends and some old friends as well. I'm so glad I get to have friends all the way across this water. If I have to leave my crazy country, somebody might put me on their couch. I should also say that it is an honor to read and to share this microphone with Marie Howe. I'll try to do this without crying. I'm so emotional right now. It's the jet lag, I promise. Marie's poems have been very important to my own development as a writer. Without her first two books, I would not exist. And the poems that she's written in those books and the books since have really helped me as a teacher as well. I don't think I would be able to explain concepts to my students if she had not made the poems that make those concepts clear. And so I thank her for that. Thank you so much, Marie, for being here. So I'm going to read just so I can get out of the way and let the real talent come through. The family I'm from, where I'm from, no matter what we're doing, we always begin with prayer. So prayer of the backhanded, not the palm, not the pear tree switch, not the broomstick, nor the closest extension cord, not his braided belt, but God bless the back of my daddy's hand, which, holding nothing tightly against me and not wrapped in leather, eliminated the air between itself and my cheek. Make full this dimpled cheek, unworthy of its unfisted print, and forgive my forgetting the love of a hand hungry for reflex, a hand that took no thought of its target, like hail from a blind sky, involuntary, fast, but brutal in its bruising. Father, I bear the bridge of what might have been a broken nose. I lift to you what was a busted lip. Bless the boy who believes his best beatings lack intention, the mark of the beast. Bring back to life the son who glories in the sin of immediacy, calling it love, God. Save the man whose arm, like an angel's invisible wing, may fly backward in fury, whether or not his son stands near. Help me hold in place my blazing jaw as I think to say, excuse me. Got this new book, y'all. The page numbers are a little different. I had to find this poem. Labor. I spent what light Saturday sent sweating and learned to cuss, cutting grass for women kind enough to say they couldn't tell the damned difference between their mowed lawns and their vacuumed carpets, just before handing over a $5 bill rolled tighter than a joint and asking me in to change a few light bulbs. I called those women old, because they wouldn't move out of a chair without my help or walk without a hand at the base of their backs. I called them old, and they must have been. They're all dead now, dead and in the earth I once tended. The loneliest people have the earth to love, and not one friend their own age, only mothers to baby them and big sisters to boss them around. Women they want to please and pray for the chance to say please to, I don't do that kind of work anymore. My job is to look at the childhood I hated and say, I once had something to do with my hands. Hero, she never knew one of us from another, so my brothers and I grew up fighting over our mother's mind. Like sun-colored suitors in a Greek myth, we were willing to do evil. We kept chocolate around our mouths. The last of her mother's lot, she cried at funerals, cried when she whipped me. She whipped me daily. I am most interested in people who declare gratitude for their childhood beatings. None of them took what my mother gave, waking us for school with sharp slaps to our bare thighs. That side of the family is darker. I should be grateful, so I will be. No one on earth knows how many abortions happened before a woman risked her freedom by giving that risk a name, by taking it to breast. I don't know why I am alive now that I still cannot impress the woman who whipped me into being. I turned my mother into a grandmother. She thanks me by kissing my sons. Gratitude is black. Black as a hero returning from war to a country that banked on his death. Thank God it doesn't get much darker than that. As a human being, there is the happiness you have and the happiness you deserve. They sit apart from one another the way you and your mother sat on opposite ends of the sofa after an ambulance came to take your father away. Some good doctor will stitch him up, and soon an aunt will arrive to drive your mother to the hospital, where she will settle next to him forever, as promised. She holds the arm of her seat as if she could fall, as if it is the only sturdy thing, and it is. Since you've done what you always wanted, you fought your father and won, marred him. He'll have a scar he can see, all because of you. And your mother, the only woman you ever cried for, must tend to it as a bride tends to her vows, forsaking all others, no matter how sore the injury. No matter how sore the injury has left you, you sit understanding yourself as a human being, finally free now that nobody's got to love you. This next poem is titled after a word that's actually not really a word. It's a word that's only predominantly, I should say, used in the American South where I'm from. I'm originally from Louisiana and I live in Atlanta, Georgia. The word is nim, and it's sort of what we might call a compound contraction, and it stands for in them, which is something people add on to the end of a, they might add it on to say not only that person at the end of a phrase, not only that person, but who you associate with that person. So often, if you haven't seen someone in a long time, they'll say something like, how is your mama and them? Which means, you know, how is your mama and the rest of everyone I knew when I knew your mother? Them. They said to say goodnight and not goodbye. Unplugged the TV when it rained. They hid money in mattresses, so to sleep on decisions. Some of their children were not their children. Some of their parents had no birth dates. They could sweat a cold out of you. They'd wake without an alarm telling them to. Even the short ones reached certain shelves. Even the skinny cooked animals too quick to catch. And I don't care how ugly one of them arrived, that one got married to somebody fine. They fed families with change and wiped their kitchens clean. Then another century came. People like me forgot their names. When I was a kid, I was really taken by and excited by riddles. So when I became an adult and I became a poet, I tried many, many times. I might not be reading this poem because I might not have it. Oh, well, I almost lied. I almost read a poem that doesn't exist. Instead, Homeland. I decided to read this because the first line is part of what I'm going through. Homeland. I knew I had jet lag because no one would make love to me. All the men thought me a vampire. All the women were women. In America that year, black people kept dreaming that the president got shot. Then the president got shot, breaking into the White House. He claimed to have lost his keys. What's the proper name for a man caught stealing into his own home? I asked a few passengers. They replied, Jigger. After that, I took the red eye. I took to a sigh deep as the end of a day in the dark fields below us. Some slept, but nobody named security ever believes me. Confiscated, my Atripla, my Celexa, my cortisone, my Clonopin, my Flexeril, my Zyrtec, my Nasarel, my Percocet, my Ambien. Nobody in this nation feels safe, and I'm still a reason why. Every day, something gets thrown away on account of long history, or hair, or fingernails, or yes, of course, my fangs. The United States, maybe I'm not reading that either. Let's see, what poems did I bring any poems with me to this reading? I'll read I've been writing a bit about sexual assault, and about rape. And the truth is, you can't really write about rape without writing about Western civilization or so-called civilization. You can't really write about that without writing about Greek myth. And so I started writing poems about Ganymede. And I think you'll figure out the myth of Ganymede as I read this poem, if you don't already know that particular myth. But what's interesting to me is Ganymede's myth has several versions, and this poem sort of makes use of one of those versions. Ganymede. A man trades his son for horses. That's the version I prefer. I like the safety of it. No one at fault, everyone rewarded. God gets the boy. The boy becomes immortal. His father rides until grief sounds as good as the gallop of an animal born to carry those who patrol our inherited kingdom. When we look at myth this way, nobody bothers saying, rape. I mean, don't you want God to want you? Don't you dream of someone with wings taking you up? And when the master comes for our children, he smells like the men who own stables in heaven, that far terrain between promise and apology. No one has to convince us. The people of my country believe we can't be hurt if we can be bought. I've invented this form called the duplex, which merges the sonnet and the huzzle and the blues. I kept trying to figure out what would be the form, like if you're a black gay man from the American South. So I came up with this, and I think you'll be able to hear how it works. There's the repetition of lines and some rhyme and sort of something going on with meter. Duplex. I begin with love, hoping to end there. I don't want to leave a messy corpse. I don't want to leave a messy corpse full of medicines that turn in the sun. Some of my medicines turn in the sun. Some of us don't need hell to be good. Those who need most need hell to be good. What are the symptoms of your sickness? Here is one symptom of my sickness. Men who love me are men who miss me. Men who leave me are men who miss me in the dream where I am an island. In the dream where I am an island, I grow green with hope. I'd like to end there. Open. I often lie open as a field. Sharecroppers have no fixed names. Billy Strayhorn wrote Lush Life while still in his teens. It's a very popular song in the United States for a period, and it's been recorded by almost everyone from Nat King Cole to Natalie Cole to Queen Latifah. Track one, Lush Life. The woman with the microphone sings to hurt you, to see you shake your head. The mic may as well be a leather belt. You drive to the center of town to be whipped by a woman's voice. You can't tell the difference between a leather belt and a lover's tongue. A lover's tongue might call you bitch, a term of endearment where you come from, a kind of compliment preceded by the word sing in certain nightclubs. A lush little tongue you have. You can yell, sing, bitch, and I love you with a shot of Patron at the end of each phrase from the same bar stool every Saturday night. But you can't remember your father's leather belt without shaking your head. That's what satisfies her, the woman with the microphone. She does not mean to entertain you, and neither do I. Speak to me in a lover's tongue. Call me your bitch, and I'll sing the whole night long. It's hot. Dark. I am sick of your sadness, Jericho Brown. Your blackness, your books, sick of you laying me down so I forget how sick I am. I'm sick of your good looks, your debates, your concern, your determination to keep your butt plump, the little money you earn. I'm sick of you saying no when yes is as easy as a young man, bored with you saying yes to every request, though you're as tired as anyone else yet consumed with a single diagnosis of health. I'm sick of your hurting. I see that you're blue. You may be ugly, but that ain't new. Everyone you know is just as cracked. Everyone you love is as dark, or at least as black. I'm going to shift gears here and finish with a few love poems. Is it okay if I read you some love poems? If they work, you might, you know, get lucky. You'd rather meet somebody at a poetry reading, I'm telling you. Colosseum. I don't remember how I hurt myself. The pain mine long enough for me to lose the wound that invented it, as none of us knows the beauty of our own eyes until a man tells us they are why God made brown. Then that same man says he lives to touch the smoothest parts, suggesting our surface area can be understood by degrees of satin. Him I will follow until I am as rough outside as I am within. I cannot locate the origin of slaughter, but I know how my own feels, that I live with it and sometimes use it to get the living done, because I am what gladiators call a man in love. Love being any reminder we survived. I wrote this I wrote this this next poem because a friend told me you're not really a poet until you write a Persephone poem. So, at the end of hell, so what if I love him? The one they call bad, the one they call black, the one with the gap in his teeth only I get to see. What if I risk taking the head of death here in the dark, far and deep, where burrowing beasts build house after filthy house, and nobody witnesses my underworld gangster play kidnap, play mama's baby turned queen, and if I scream pastel, he swears he's sorry, unties my feet. What if that's worth a few bruises better than the light called spring? And I love it, every drop of God weeping over me. Your body made heavy with gin. I can relax. I smell liquor on your breath. Soon your arms will be too heavy to lift, and I'll watch the weight of you shiver while you sleep. But first, I want to see that stagger, like a boy sent off to battle, shot, then sent back. I kept one once. He'd never get a good dose, only quake and dream of hands aimed at his throat. He'd cough and gag. I'd shake him awake. He was, as you are. He could have died in my bed. He could have never stopped dreaming. He'd take me for the enemy. We'd fight. But you and I won't fight tonight. I'll remember some limping lover and talk all I want about war. Or maybe I won't. Maybe I don't care who survives. I only need to watch your body made heavy with gin as I hold you up from your fall at the threshold, because I love you, and I love you best with liquor on your breath, when I can get a good look at you, just the way I found you, reeking and too drunk to go after the roaches with the heel of your hand, and too drunk to take me for one of the roaches. You'll hear some, this is another duplex, you'll hear some echoes of lines because it's a cento. When I was done, my editor asked me to do this odd thing. He asked me if I could make a poem where I put all the duplexes together. So I tried, and this is what I came up with. Duplex, cento. My last love drove a burgundy car, color of a rash, a symptom of sickness. We were the symptoms, the road our sickness. None of our fights ended where they began. None of the beaten end where they begin. Any man in love can cause a messy corpse. But I didn't want to leave a messy corpse obliterated in some lilied field. Stench obliterating lilies of the field, the murderer young and unreasonable. He was so young, so unreasonable. Steadfast and awful, tall as my father. Steadfast and awful, my tall father was my first love. He drove a burgundy car. Of my fury, I love a man I know could die. And not by way of illness and not by his own hand, but because the color of that hand and all his flawless skin. One joy in it is understanding he can hurt me, but won't. I thought by now I'd be unhappy, unconscious, next to the same lover so many nights in a row. He readies for bed right on the other side of my fury. But first I make a braid of us. I don't sleep until I get what I want. Stand. Peace on this planet, or guns glowing hot. We lay there together as if we were getting something done. It felt like planting a garden, or planning a meal for a people who still need feeding. all that touching or barely touching, not saying much, not adding anything, the cushion of it, the skin and occasional sigh, all seemed like work worth mastering. I'm sure somebody died while we made love. Somebody killed, somebody black. I thought then of holding you as a political act. I may as well have held myself. We didn't stand for one thought, didn't do a damn thing. And though you left me, I'm glad we didn't. I'm going to finish with one last poem. Do I have time for one, or am I? So hot. They told me there was a fan that was blowing straight on you, and they lied. People, well, that's not straight on me. Jeez, I feel like I should be mowing the lawn. My God, I knew y'all was going to put me to work. Okay, last poem. Thank y'all so much. Y'all are so, and it's so hot, and y'all are listening to all these poems. Thank you. Heart condition. I don't want to hurt a man, but I like to see one beg. Two people touch twice a month in 10 hotels, and we call it long distance. He holds down one coast. I wander the other like any African American. Africa with its condition, and America with its condition, and black folk born in this nation content to carry half of each. I shoulder my share. My man flies to touch me. Sky on our side. Sky above his world I wish to write, which is where I go wrong. Words are a sense of sound. I get smart. My mother shakes her head. My grandmother sighs. He ain't got no sense. My grandmother is dead. She lives with me. I hear my mother shake her head over the phone. Somebody cut the cord. We have a long distance relationship. I lost half of her to a stroke. God gives to each a body. God gives everybody its pains. When pain mounts in my body, I try thinking of my white forefathers who hurt their black bastards quite legally. I hate to say it, but one pain can ease another. Doctors rather I take pills. My man wants me to see a doctor. What are you? When you leave your man wanting, what am I now that I think so fondly of airplanes? What's my name? Whose is it while we make love? My lover leaves me with words I wish to write, flies from one side of a nation to the outside of our world. I don't want the world. I only want African sense of American sound. Him touching this body, aware of its pains. Greetings, earthlings. My name is slow and stumbling. I come from planet trouble. I am here to love you, uncomfortable. Thank y'all so much.
Before we start the second reading, could one of the techies come and help with this? We want to put it on the step. Is that better?
Yeah, it's just that it was too low, so maybe I'm tall or something.
Oh. Yeah, sure. I'll do the intro and you go to the loo. Yeah, you go to the loo and I'll do the intro.
She said, I'll miss you. She wants to see you, Neil.
Right. As well as going to the toilet, Marie Howe has published four books of poetry, all published by Norton, most recently Magdalene, in 2017. Her first collection, The Good Thief, 1988, was followed by What the Living Do, 1997, and The Kingdom of Ordinary Time, 2009. I've long been an admirer of Marie's work, and I included her poems in three of Bloodaxe's world poetry anthologies, Being Alive, Being Human, and Soul Food. And if Norton can be persuaded, we're very much hoping to publish her first selected poems in the UK before too long. There's always a difficulty with American poets. If they don't have a publisher here, events like this, it's very difficult to get hold of the books. We've been fortunate with Jericho, because he's just been published by Picador, but we've not managed to get many books from Norton for this event, so I hope in future we can correct that the next time Marie comes here. There are some of her books at the back, but some of the cannier members of the audience have been buying them before the reading. So I'm sorry to say there won't be many for you at the back at the end of the reading, because you'll all be wanting to buy her books. Nick Flynn has said, Marie Howe has always come as close as any poet since Rilke to touching eternity simply by stretching out her hand and believing that something exists beyond her grasp, beyond her knowing. Nowhere more so, I would say, than in Magdalene, which imagines the biblical figure of Mary Magdalene as a woman who embodies the spiritual and sensual, alive in a contemporary landscape. Between facing the traumas of her past and navigating daily life, the narrator of Magdalene yearns for the guidance of her spiritual teacher, a Christ figure, whose death she continues to grieve. Alicia Ostreicher says of the book, Marie Howe is among our most gifted poets of trauma and healing, and where the everyday encounters the world of the sacred. In Magdalene, Howe raises the ante. She now channels the woman taken in adultery of the New Testament legend, and she is also her questing self, lover and mother, risen to the exaltation of the possible. Some of you may remember Mark Doty's event last weekend. He read his poem Lost in the Stars, in which Marie features. And Mark Doty has written of her, each book of Marie Howe's is a singular accomplishment, and none is as wildly alive as this. How does she see with such devastating clarity, or allow so much of what the living do onto the page? Avoidance, longing, tenderness, resentment, and desire. What makes the engine go? The wry, knowing, seeking voice of Mary Magdalene, worn like the most transparent of masks. The experience of mothering a daughter, a long arc of building into its house in the years, of love building its house in the years. Howe sweeps up a life and fixes it on the page and stands here before us, the stunned and grateful witness of all that's taken and granted by love and time. Will you please welcome Marie Howe.
Thank you. Where did Jericho go? Oh, there you are. How are you doing, old Jericho? Well, Neil, thank you. Pamela, thank you. Adam and Nellie, thank you. The Arts Council, thank you. Thank you for all being here this morning. I need to pour a little water. Don't believe anything Neil just told you. Jericho, we're alive. It's so amazing. We're all here. We're all alive. It's a great miracle, isn't it? It could have been otherwise. Mary Magdalene, I grew up with these stories of what we call the Old and New Testament, or the Torah and the Gospels. And these figures, to me, were archetypical. And even as a young girl, I knew that what was really happening was happening in between the words of the stories, in the silences of the stories. What the Jewish tradition calls a midrash, where you imagine into these silent places. Magdalene, of course, is our girl, right? Women in the room? I mean, she is our girl. She was, of course, shaped and personified by the early church fathers as a repentant prostitute. There's no evidence that she was that at all, but that's what she has come to us through the centuries as, and unfortunately has served as the unwitting foil to Mary the Virgin. We have Mary, we have Mary Magdalene, and there has been the plight of women for centuries. We've been split between the body and the spirit, between the virgin and the whore, and separated from ourselves. So this book is Magdalene's attempt to try to integrate those aspects of herself, and or I guess, and it begins with a quote from the Gnostic Gospels. Have any of you read the Gnostic Gospels? Yeah, they were the Gospels that were outlawed by the early church fathers. There were many, many Gospels written after Jesus died, as you can imagine. I knew him. No, I knew him. No, I knew him. I knew him. I know. I know. No, I know. And the Gnostics were a very different group of people. Women and men lived together in a circular, power-sharing way. Many different aspects of belief about the body and the spirit, gnosis. The gospel, according to Thomas, this is where this quote is from. His disciples said, "When will you be visible to us? And when will we see you?" And Jesus said, "When you undress and are not ashamed." Before the beginning, was I ever virgin? Did someone touch me before I could speak? Who had me before I knew I was an I? So that I wanted that touch again and again without knowing who or why or from whence it came. How the story started. I was driven toward desire by desire, believing that the fulfillment of that desire was an end. There was no end. Others might have looked into the future and seen a shape inside the coming years, a house, a child, a man who might be a help. I saw his back bent over what he was working on, the back of his neck, how he stood in his sneakers and wanted to eat him. How could I see another person? I mean, who he was apart from me, apart from that. The affliction. When I walked across a room, I saw myself walking as if I were someone else. When I picked up a fork, when I pulled off a dress, as if I were in a movie. It's what I thought you saw when you looked at me. So when I looked at you, I didn't see you. I saw the me I thought you saw, as if I were someone else. I called that outside, watching. Well, I didn't call it anything when it happened all the time. But one morning, after I stopped taking the pills, standing in the kitchen for 1 second, I was inside looking out. Then I popped back outside and saw myself looking. Would it happen again? It did. A few days later, my friend Wendy was pulling on her winter coat, standing by the kitchen door, and suddenly I was inside and I saw her. I looked out from my own eyes and I saw her eyes, blue, gray, transparent, and inside them, Wendy herself. Then I was outside again. And Wendy was saying, "Bye-bye, see you soon," as if nothing had happened. She hadn't noticed. She hadn't noticed that I had been there for maybe 40 seconds and that then I was gone. She hadn't noticed that I hadn't been there for months. Years, the entire time she had known me, I needn't have been embarrassed to have been there for those seconds. She had not noticed the difference. This happened on and off for weeks. And then I was looking at my old friend John. suddenly I was in, and I saw him. And this was almost unbearable. He saw me see him, and I saw him see me. He said something like, "You're going to be okay now," or, "It's been difficult, hasn't it?" But what he said mattered only a little. We met in our mutual gaze, in between, a third place I had not yet been. Magdalene on men, their bodies. One penis was large and thick, so when he put it inside me, I really did say, "Wow." One penis was uncircumcised, and I loved to grip the shaft and pull down so the head popped out like a little man. One penis was curved, so I had to move in a different way. One penis was so friendly, I was never afraid of it. One penis was so slender, I was startled. One penis was blunt and short, like a small pig. One penis couldn't harden until he stuffed it soft inside me. One penis came as soon as I started to move. "I'm so sorry," he said. "I have a problem, but I didn't care. I loved that boy." One penis pressed against me hard almost every morning, but I got out of bed as if I hadn't heard a word it had said. One penis was so dear to me, I kissed it and kissed it even after I knew it had been with someone else. One penis I never saw, but my hand came to know it from the outside of his jeans. One penis loved the inside of my mouth so much it sang, it sputtered. One had a name. One was a mouse. One, he explained to me, had very, very tiny crabs, so we couldn't have sex for a while. One was orthodox and wouldn't touch blood. One had a mole, a hard little dot just under the rim. One penis was extremely patient without making a big deal about it. One penis had a great sense of humor. One penis had herpes, but I didn't know that word yet. One was a battering ram. One was a drunk, staggering, a lout, a bully. One slept inside me, comfortably at home. Muriel Rukeyser is a great American poet of the 20th century, and she is the one who said, "What would happen if a woman told the truth about her life? The world would split open." And of course, women have been telling the truth about their lives only recently, like since, you know, really getting published in the late 60s, 70s, 80s, when I was in graduate school. We did not read many women poets at all. And so I'm grateful to every single woman who's ever written for writing at all and trying to speak to what had not been said. So there's a great story in the Old Testament about Moses, I love Moses, who went up and down the mountain talking to Yahweh, remember? And the people, he would come down and tell the people what to do. And at one point, the people said, "Look, we don't even believe you're talking to Yahweh. We need to hear him. You know, we need to hear his voice." So this poem references that moment. It's called "The Teacher." When Moses pleaded and Yahweh agreed at last to let the people hear his voice, it is said that he allowed each person to hear what each could bear to the very brim of that, and no more. Afterwards, the people said, "Please, Moses, from now on, you listen. We don't want to hear it. You do the talking and listening now." Being with the teacher was a little like that, as though he were a book too difficult to read, So I thought I had to become more than I was, more than I'd been. But that wasn't it. It seemed rather that something had to go. Something had to be let go of. It wasn't that I saw something new or saw suddenly into him, not that, not ever. But that the room itself, whatever room we might be standing in, assumed a clarity. And the things in the room, a table, a cup, a meowing cat. The disciples. You can imagine Mary and the disciples. She's not believed. I suppose it's always like that with the teacher. Everyone wanted his gaze, as if it were water at noon. But it was women who made the food, women who opened their homes to us, their quiet daughters standing in the doorway, the little ones being told to let him rest, let him eat. And they hadn't cooked a dish. It was still the old way, although they all talked about the new way, the new way. For me, it was different. I knew that even when he seemed not to be looking at me, he was. But of course, I was wrong about that too. Remember the Garden of Gethsemane, where Jesus goes the night before he's arrested, well, the night he is arrested, really, and he's about to be tortured and murdered in public. Magdalene has a different version of that. This is called Magdalene on Gethsemane. When he went to the garden the night before and fell with his face to the ground, what he imagined was not his own torture, not his death. That's what the story says, but that's not what he told me. He said he saw the others, the countless, in his name, raped, burned, lynched, stoned, bombed, beheaded, shot, gassed, gutted, and raped again. We know very little about Magdalene. In the Gospel of Luke, she is referred to as Mary from Magdalene, from whom seven devils have been cast out. Now, anybody here have devils? It's nice to be in the company of people who have devils. Magdalene, the seven devils. Well, the first was that I was very busy. The second, I was different from you. Whatever happened to you could not happen to me, not like that. The third, I worried. The fourth, envy, disguised as compassion. The fifth was that I refused to consider the quality of life of the aphid. The aphid disgusted me, but I couldn't stop thinking about it. The mosquito, too, its face, and the ant, its bifurcated body. Okay, the first was that I was so busy. The second, that I might make the wrong choice because I had decided to take that plane that day, that flight before noon, so as to arrive early. And I shouldn't have wanted that. The third was that if I walked past a certain place on the street, the house would blow up. The fourth was that I was made of guts and blood with a thin layer of skin lightly thrown over the whole thing. The fifth was that the dead seemed more alive to me than the living. The sixth, if I touched my right arm, I had to touch my left arm. And if I touched the left arm a little harder than I'd first touched the right, then I had to retouch the left and then touch the right again so it would be even. The seventh, I knew I was breathing the expelled breath of everything that was alive, and I couldn't stand it. I wanted a sieve, a mask, a cheesecloth, to breathe through that would trap it. Whatever was inside everyone else that entered me when I breathed in. No, that was the first one. The second was that I was so busy, I had no time. How had this happened? How had our lives gotten like this? The third was that I couldn't eat food if I really saw it distinct and separate from me in a bowl or on a plate. Okay, the first was that I could never get to the end of the list. The second was that the laundry was never finally done. The third was that no one knew me, although they thought they did, and that if people thought of me as little as I thought of them, then what was love? The fourth was that I didn't belong to anyone. I wouldn't allow myself to belong to anyone. The fifth was that I knew none of us could ever know what we didn't know. The sixth was that I projected onto others what I myself was feeling. The seventh was the way my mother looked when she was dying. No, the sound she made. Her mouth wrenched to the right and cupped open so as to take in as much air. The gurgling sound so loud we had to speak louder to hear each other over it, and that I couldn't stop hearing it. Years later, grocery shopping, crossing the street. No, not the sound. It was her body's hunger. Finally evident what our mother had hidden all her life. For months I dreamt of knuckle bones and roots, the slabs of sidewalk pushed up like crooked teeth by what grew underneath. The underneath, that was the first devil. It was always with me. And that I didn't think you, if I told you, would understand any of this. Thank you very much for your company. Thank you.